Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics with me, Steve Richards, the podcast where we delve deep into British politics. And we've got a lot of delving to do in our time together during this podcast. So thanks for tuning in. Thanks for your brilliant questions. So this is what we're going to do in our time together, if it's okay with all of you. In a minute, a few assembly notices, bit of detail about things, because I'm on the road in different places in March for the first time in this election year. I'm going to be on the road quite a lot in this election year. And then I'm going to be reflecting on why it is that there are these blazing, angry rows over issues which, when you step back, there is quite a degree of consensus. I'm talking about the Israel-Gaza nightmare. And why this is where kind of most people agree, and yet Britain apparently is falling apart over it. And Sunak has had to do a statement outside Number 10 last Friday, and so on. And yet, where there is huge disagreement, or should be, there is a kind of near silence. It's weird at the moment, British politics, rather like American politics, actually. In fact, the parallels with American politics are deep, I think, and disturbing. The Tory party, there are many parallels with the Republican Party in the existential crisis it's going through. And sometimes you can see it coming together with, you know, Liz Truss going out to speak at that wacky Republican conference the week before last, talking of which, when we come to your brilliant emails, I got many, as I knew I would, to be honest, about the podcast last week, where my reflection was on the question of whether Liz Truss had a point. Submerged in all the kind of mockery and lofty disdain, virtually wholly justified about the Truss arguments over her period in power. I argued, for those of you who weren't there, that there was one question she raises, which is interesting and important. Now, she might be utterly disingenuous in applying the question to her month in Number 10, but that does not invalidate the question, which is where power lies in the United Kingdom, whether non-elected bodies such as the OBR playing a big role in this week of Jeremy Hunt's budget. Some of you will be listening to this post-budget, some of you pre-budget. It doesn't matter. We know already the role of the OBR in acting as maybe an admirably constraining force, but nonetheless a force. The other things, the IMF and the Bank of England, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, in my suggesting that there is an interesting question there, got some brilliant responses. We'll be coming to them. So, yeah, we've got a lot to cram in. So let's get to the notices right away. I've made a note of the notices. Sometimes I don't need to, but there's a lot going on. So, yeah, first live show of the year will be at the Rope Tackle Centre in Shoreham on March the 13th. You can get tickets in the link to the podcast, or just go to the Rope Tackle and book your tickets there at the legendary Art Centre. We always have a fantastic time together there. Then, just a few days later, on my never-ending tour, like Dylan, Saturday, March the 16th, the York Book Festival, at 7 o'clock, and you can get tickets for that via the York Theatre Royal website, and that link will be in the blurb for the podcast. There's parking at the venue. It's at St. Peter's School in Clifton in York, and so you can get tickets to the York Theatre Royal website. And then March the 26th, as the May elections move into view, we will be able to make sense of the aftermath of one of the final cards of this strange government, the budget. March the 26th, the first live show of the year at King's Place, and you can get your tickets for that on the King's Place website or with the blurb that accompanies the podcast. Now, Those are the notices, and I hope to see as many of you as possible at one of those. Shoreham, York, King's Place in London, in the main concert hall there in the coming days. Oh, yeah, by the way, in King's Place, if you're miles away, like if you live on the moon or live in Jordan or Amsterdam, as I know some of you do, you can buy streaming tickets for the live King's Place show. The combination of the two, by the way, will be the same as an audience that fills, say, the O2 Centre in London. But we have the intimacy of the concert hall rather than the dehumanising O2. Just raise that as an example. Anyway, see you all there. Now, to my point, if it's all right with all of you. There is so much that we should all be having blazing rows about, given the rotten state of Britain. And they kind of essentially should revolve around economic policy, tax and spend, those lethal words, the role of the state, growth, productivity. They're all interconnected, quality of public services, how you hold to account those that deliver public services, etc. Huge debates and wholly legitimate and inevitable disagreement. And yet, apparently, the UK, according to Rishi Sunak, with that symbolic speech outside number 10 with the podium, a symbolism usually used when a prime minister is calling a surprise election. Do you remember Theresa May? Just after Easter in 2017, after a little walking holiday, she came and outside number 10 called that dramatic election, the result of which didn't meet with the expectations of commentators. So it's sort of been airbrushed out of history. But it was a moment of drama that wholly justified the Downing Street podium. Now, in Sunak's case, it seemed to have been triggered finally by the Rochdale by-election and the election of George Galloway, which was weird in itself because although it was a very odd by-election, no formally endorsed Labour candidate, as we know, he did win democratically. But this clearly disturbed Sunak in the same way, let's be honest, that us Remainers were disturbed by the outcome of the Brexit referendum. And many of us supported the idea, although it was an extreme one, of a second one, second referendum. Anyway, he didn't like the result, and there he was on the podium. But on this issue, even though George Galloway fumed at Sunak, fumed at Starmer, of course there are differences. And yet, if you stand back, even in that insane day in the House of Commons, when the Speaker allowed the Labour amendment to be debated and voted on and has clearly lost the confidence of some MPs and lost his own self-confidence as a result, even that day, there was broad agreement about the need for a ceasefire now. Indeed, the leader of the SNP at Westminster said that he agreed with the Labour motion, which called for a ceasefire. Starmer, a few days before that Commons debate, had gone up to the Scottish Labour Conference and called for a ceasefire now. And that's broadly the position. Cameron, who sometimes has been ahead of the arc compared with Starmer, has called for a ceasefire. The definitions around it and the conditions around it may differ. And of course, those differences are important. But there you have, say, George Galloway, Keir Starmer, David Cameron, Rishi Sunak in different ways lining up, calling for a ceasefire. And most people in the argument here and indeed elsewhere say two things, that the attack on October the 7th was a horror, and what Israel is doing to Gaza is beyond horrendous and appalling and disproportionate and almost certainly breaking international law. the almost certainty, that's not me speaking, that's what the most qualified assessment might be. And so I can fully understand why people still go on the marches, and they're entirely legitimate to do so. I can understand the worries within the Labour Party about Keir Starmer's early responses, which were interesting and worth exploring, I think. The week of the party conference in Liverpool, which followed the October the 7th massacre, is a really interesting example of how a leader and his advisors in the office become blinded by the kind of media mood at the conference. So, you know, the media mood post October the 7th, the terrible massacre at the kibbutz happened on, I think, was it the Saturday? And the Labour Party conference opened the following day. And the media mood was, thank God, this is not Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, it's Keir Starmer's Labour Party, they're taking responsible stand, etc. You know, sort of every cliche in the book. So by the time Starmer came to be interviewed by Nick Ferrari on LBC in that famous interview where he appeared, he claims differently, but he did say Israel had the right to withdraw or block food and water supplies to Gaza. I suspect it was part of a sense that this is the new Labour Party under me and not Jeremy Corbyn, and wholly misread the degree to which senior figures in the Labour Party would become alarmed by the response in Gaza and the Muslim communities. And so I can understand people being worked up about that internally, why some would have voted for that SNP motion if it had been called on the SNP day in the House of Commons, a more sort of sweeping statement calling for a ceasefire now, even though they would have also voted, you know, for the Labour amendment calling for a ceasefire now, but with conditions outlined. And by the way, it's perfectly legitimate for Starmer or Sunak to outline the conditions for a ceasefire. It's not going to happen in a vacuum. It will be negotiated with conditions applied. But I can understand some in Labour being worried that Keir Starmer's instinct has been to hug behind Washington, an echo of Tony Blair hugging behind Washington. But of course, it was a different Washington then, with the George Bush administration. The Biden administration is very different from that, although some are very critical of the way Biden has dealt with it. In truth, we don't know wholly what has gone on behind the scenes in terms of diplomacy, and diplomacy is what we all want. Anyway, we can understand the differences, and there are two extremes who are part of this kind of seemingly explosive mix, one of which would be that the Hamas attack was justified because of the approach of the Israeli government to Palestinians and Gaza and Palestinians outside Gaza for decades. And others on the other side say Israel has got every right to slaughter people in Gaza because they've got every right and duty to wipe out Hamas, even though, incidentally, how that happens is by no means clear. Now, there are those two extremes, but on the whole, there is this kind of general consensus. And yet, look at it. You know, people worked up about George Galloway, the Labour candidate, being dumped in Rochdale. Say Sunak in a podium saying all this has got to stop, although, you know, the grandeur and emollient tone was still pretty vague in terms of ends. And incidentally, also as an assessment of the state of Britain at the moment. And I think one of the reasons why there is such a focus on this and this other thing called woke issues. By the way, of course there should be a focus on it. What's going on is a dark nightmare in Gaza. But why there is this kind of mood or a sense of it becoming supremely important as an issue of difference and disagreement and politics is because there is a sort of vacuum on all the issues we should be disagreeing with each other about. And in a way, the Rochdale by-election was an example of that. Rochdale is a town which is sort of economically stagnant, like much of Britain, and poor, and needs huge amounts of imaginative investment to climb out of the terrible state a lot of these towns are in. But how you do that, whether you accept that government has a responsibility to drive such a revival, that should have been the whole kind of debate in Rochdale. I'm sure it was partly. And George Galloway said many things on domestic issues. It wasn't just about Gaza, but we all know he sort of personifies a kind of view on Gaza that was clearly central to that by-election. And let's look at this budget. You see the budget, tax cuts. It's fascinating, the Tory obsession with tax cuts. And they've got every right to work on the assumption it drives economic recovery, although there's no evidence that what has happened so far in that respect has done. Remember, they've already cut national insurance quite substantially, and it came into effect in January. It's neither helped them electorally or kind of been an engine of growth in any sense of the word. And yet here we have tax cuts. And for reasons that we've explored many times here, Labour are wary of engaging with that tax and spend debate. There is an assumption, which is not wholly right, actually, about previous elections, that if ever an election is about tax and spend, Labour loses and the Tories win. It's not the case, really. And it's very interesting in recent times. You know, Labour were 20% ahead when they were committed to a £28 billion green recovery plan to compete with Europe and Biden in the United States. Now they've dropped it. It's still roughly the same. The Tories were 20 points behind before they cut national insurance. Now they've cut national insurance. They're still 20 points behind. And there were many debates in previous elections, 64, 66, the two in 74, 2001, actually, where tax and spend were big, big themes, and Labour won in different ways. But I can understand the hesitation. However, it's absolutely something we should all get worked up about and disagree about. But there's very little. There will be a consensus that the Tory tax and spend levels will be the ones that Labour inherit and stick to broadly at first. We should be screaming from the rooftop that what we now need is investment on an epic scale in the NHS, in public transport, in infrastructure projects, in levelling up. It's not the only thing, of course. That magic word reform comes into it, and then we need a big, angry, raging debate about what form reform should take, because the twist is that reform, everyone agrees with. Everyone agrees with the need the need for reform, from Jeremy Hunt to Tony Blair to Jeremy Corbyn. The argument is over what sort of reform should accompany increased investment. And then we need a debate about ownership, the debate that Margaret Thatcher won and continues to win, even though she's no longer alive. Are the models for running water? We know about the trains, energy. Are they the right ones? Now, implicitly, Labour are challenging these things. They're going to have a publicly owned energy company. They claim to have ideas about regulation that will change the way the privatised water companies function. They will gradually, still committed to public ownership of the railways. But we haven't had a big debate about why. That great question in British politics, why are Labour proposing good policies on these issues? And why the 14 years of Tory rule have led to a position where such policies are necessary? In other words, you know, Thatcher would do the why first, why public ownership was bad and privatization would deliver, why monetarism would work and the policies of the 60s and 70s had been such a catastrophic failure. Why? And then the other side disagree and you have a big row, you go out, maybe have demonstrations on all those things. But all the things we disagree on are being sort of tentatively, politely danced around, or there is a pretense that a consensus is in place, that taxes are too high, that public spending is too high and not this part of the solution to Britain's huge mountainous problems. And on Gaza, Israel, where there is a broad consensus that a ceasefire is urgently needed so the slaughtering stops, and we're all having blazing rows about it all over the place. Anyway, I think the blazing rows should be elsewhere, while our intensity and horror at what's happening, of course, remains fully in place, and hope that there is a ceasefire that at least reduces the political temperature here and elsewhere in relation to Gaza, and most fundamentally of all, ends the slaughter, is something that virtually everyone is hoping for. Anyway, what a mad time we're in. And now, talking of madness, over to your responses to my reflections on Liz Truss. Now, for those of you new to the podcast, we are in the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative in a never-ending debate, which you're more than welcome to join. It's great. Each week, there are new people writing and saying, I've listened for years, but this is the first time I've emailed and so on. So please do join in. The email is steverick14@icloud.com. Steverick, R-I-C, 14@icloud.com. Looking forward to hearing from you during this week of high drama with the budget, speculation about a May election, which some of you have written to me saying you think it will be. And I said, I don't think it will. And I still don't, actually. But if it's going to happen, it will be announced this month. So, yeah, nerve-shredding days we're living through here in our cooperative. Anyway, so I summarised at the beginning my thoughts about the Liz Truss speech and how it triggered that one interesting question. Over now to all of you. And Lizzie Price wrote, see, I mentioned the OBR as one example. Now, I kind of know people who've worked at the OBR at the highest level and rate them hugely, in awe of them. But it has power. And it was put there by George Osborne as his equivalent of Bank of England independence. And it is a powerful force. Anyway, Lizzie Price makes the point, if Truss had engaged with the OBR before her disastrous budget, might it not have been such a calamity for her personally, for the rest of us economically? Wasn't part of the collapse of confidence in Truss a result of the fact that she had refused to engage in a conversation with the OBR in advance of her announcement? Since their whole purpose is to assess the impact of government financial decisions in a national and international context, confidence in her government plummeted, perhaps not only because of what she did, but how she did it. After all, Brexit wasn't thwarted by the OBR, however disastrous their predictions rightly were. And all the decisions taken by Sunak as Chancellor during COVID went ahead, however unprecedented in nature and scale. Yeah, now that is interesting. You are right that there are radical policies that can be implemented with the OBR looking on. I mean, the OBR could not contradict a referendum result. Well, it could contradict it and did point out some of the dire implications, as Lizzie suggests, but it couldn't stop it. It couldn't counter the verdict of the people, in inverted commas, and nor did it over COVID stop what was clearly an essential, huge spending program, basically to keep companies alive when a few were working. So they are examples, but they're pretty unusual situations in both cases. What I do think is interesting is this, that Lizzie is right that the first point of turbulence under Truss was even before Kwarteng had spoken, her chancellor, when it was announced that they would not be submitting their propositions to for the scrutiny of the OBR. And that's when the trouble began for them. Now, you know, the OBR would have performed for all of us an important role in trying to constrain the madness that was being instigated. However, us lot, or most of us lot in the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative, disagreed with what that democratically elected government wanted to do, disagreed profoundly. But did that mean they should have been blocked from doing it? And that's what I find interesting. Say a government came in, which could happen, a Labour government seeking to address the dire state of public services and wanted to borrow to spend and argued that in doing so, they would over time be able to pay back the borrowing because they were going to regenerate the economy and raise funds as a result. And the OBR come in and say, you know, you've got no fiscal headroom to do that. And the borrowing will be off the scale, you know, and it has now an authority to completely derail something that some of us in the cooperative might seek. Anyway, it's a complicated thing. And so I'm not, and the OBR are brilliant, and the current leadership of the OBR are brilliant and will play an important role on Wednesday. And without them, you know, we would only get the viewpoint almost, although, of course, Keir Starmer responds for Labour, but the viewpoint of the democratically elected chancellor. But he is the democratically elected chancellor. There is this issue about democracy, I think, which needs exploring more. But thank you for that. Susan Elsmore, local politician from Cardiff. Interestingly to me, you didn't mention the Tufton Street think tanks as hidden power brokers or power holders. Less important than the IMF, Bank of England and OBR, of course, but influential nonetheless. Very good point. But you see, they are non-elected. But as think tanks, they publish reports, often they get ignored. In this case, a democratically elected prime minister wanted to use the Tufton Street lot, not only as a source of ideas, but in number 10, a load of them came into number 10. But she was the one making that call. And she, you know, again, us lot were alarmed seeing them all move in. But that there was a connection with what she was trying to do. And she was, you know, I know she hadn't won a general election, but she was the legitimate prime minister. So anyway, thank you, though, Susan. It's a good point. I mean, they had briefly an influence to die for, and we nearly all did suffer. Well, we did suffer. I was going to say to die for, but that metaphor is so, everything's so explosive at the moment. I'm not going to. Jeff Strange said, you mentioned such august bodies as the IMF and OBR, but these quangos are minnows when compared to the likes of the influential management consultancies, and especially the big five, Boston Consulting, PwC, Deloitte, KPMG, and EY. These guys have made such huge and rapid inroads into not only the mechanical running of the government machine, but also in the world of policymaking. It appears that these big five are essentially a massive outsourced policy bureau and leave in their wake an infantilized rump of a below-average political ruling class and, dare I say, civil service. Just look at the figures. At the time of the 79 election, government spending on management consulting was a mere £6 million. Fast forward to 1990, when Thatcher left the stage, the spending was a whopping £246 million. That's a really good point. So this is why I think it's an interesting question. So thank you, Jeff, for putting another side of it, which where does power lie? And now they don't actually wield measurable power, these big management consultancies. But they do in a way because they are brought in to do all sorts of things in the world of outsourcing. And they cost a fortune. And sometimes they're doing what the civil service should be doing, as Jeff implies. Indeed, a friend of mine once was working on a project which literally mirrored Home Office civil servants, but came from one of these consultancies because they didn't trust the civil servants. And it's another case of measuring their influence and holding them to account. And the BBC, you can't move for BBC managers to this very day. And yet whenever a decision has to be made about a structural issue, they bring in these consultancies. And then the consultancies disappear and aren't accountable for what they recommend and the cost involved. So it's a good point. Where does power lie? That's the only thing, I think, which arises from the trust intervention of significance. Linda Creek says, she pointed out an article from Paul Mason. Paul Mason disagreed with on some issues, but he wrote in the New European questioning how Rachel Reeves would manage the potential dampening impact if the OBR rules on investment plans, as Rachel Reeves proposes, to extend the power of the OBR to do. Paul Mason makes the point, without a reform to the OBR's remit and terms of reference, well, that's where it becomes crucial, the terms of reference to legitimise, hopefully, some forms of urgently needed investment. And Linda points out, breaking out of that straitjacket seems vital to the success of any plans, for example, for green investment, even in the diminished form of spending that Labour now proposes. Its ambition is as high, of course. Okay, on to Naveen Bhalla, I think, or Bhalla, Bhalla. I listened to Does Liz Truss Have a Point episode, and you'll be pleased to know, despite expectations, I only swore once. However, there were many sighs. Usually Truss's appearances in the media anger me for reasons I'll leave to the cooperative's imagination. As I'm breaking my silence, this, I think, a new emailer, you see what I mean? More and more people riding in. I thought I'd ask you a question about something I think a lot of commentators have missed. I like to view the polls regularly. I find it reassuring to know that the pattern of the polls shows the Tories in deep trouble. But it seems, and this is a close follower of opinion polls, it seems to me that when Sunak became Prime Minister, he slowly but steadily began regaining vote share. This continued until April 2023. When the Tory voting intention began declining. So I've been wondering, what was the event that broke Sunak's momentum? I was quite shocked when I saw a version of a poll with numerous events annotated. The key event seems to be the resignation of Dominic Raab. Well, isn't that interesting that Sunak was doing all right? He never had that John Major effect of changing the polls in a significant way, but was doing all right. And then it went to sort of Johnson Truss levels. And Raab was a trigger. Well, I don't think he was the trigger. But there was, it's funny, we've all forgotten about Raab and his resignation. But it was a reminder that Sunak had the space, I think, to play the integrity card, which is quite an easy card for a prime minister to play, even after this period of Tory rule, because it's not about the complexities of economic policy or industrial policy or how you improve public services, all of which are nightmarishly challenging. But you absolutely could have, I think, even though he didn't win a poll of the party members, symbolise a break on integrity. And of course, instead of what happened, is you had the whole Johnson thing. He didn't vote in the House of Commons. Sunak on the Johnson affair. Raab was his deputy. And of course, Dominic Raab campaigned for Rishi Sunak. So he was... So there was a sense of a continuity of senior Tory figures who were then in different ways forced out. And maybe that fueled the kind of, oh, yeah, Sunak hasn't got it mood that still is very deep to this very day. Thank you very much. Sean Farrell is interesting about the role of Jim O'Neill, the former Goldman Sachs chief economist. He says, apparently, Jim O'Neill, who's doing some work for Labour now, he's done some work as a crossbencher for the Tories. He's now doing some work for Labour. Apparently says, and this is interesting, the OBR should be responsible for scrutinising public investments to make sure they have large multipliers. By multipliers, it means that the economic impact spreads and intensifies. So you spend some money, but by doing so, you create far more money, to be crude about it. He sees this as a way to increase public investment by altering the fiscal rules in favour of that investment. He's a big influence, I think, Jim O'Neill. And I think the fiscal rules and how they are defined are crucial. Because fiscal rules can create a mood of stability, reassure the markets, the right-wing media. But if they create too much of a straitjacket, a Labour chancellor becomes trapped. But the art is to create a straitjacket that reassures while having the freedom to invest. Anyway, well, as Sean Farrell says, I live in hope that those will be the kind of rules, fiscal rules. Simon Page, Liz Truss was not stopped by unelected bodies. She was stopped by the party MPs. And this is as it should be, because we elect a parliament through a party system. We don't elect a prime minister. Good point, Simon. Liz Truss was she resigned, actually. But it was the mood of the parliamentary party that made it impossible in the end for her to carry on. But that mood was created by the response of the IMF, the OBR, the et cetera, et cetera. And it's fine. We have a broad church of listeners. But a lot of us were horrified by those few weeks. A lot of Tories were. But as I say, it's this question of where power lies. You're right. In the end, she couldn't sustain the support in the parliamentary party. Look, there are so many questions on Liz Truss and many other brilliant questions as well. But I'm going to stop now because I'm on the road even before those announced dates. I'm on the road in a slightly different way. But we've got the budget on Wednesday, so do subscribe. Depending on what happens then, who knows? It might be a damp squib. It might be highly significant. We might gather again later in the week, in which case I can read out more questions. I've made a note of where I have stopped. And it's, I've got a lot more to come. We got Phil Chamberlain. Did I say Simon Page? I've stopped at Simon, your question. But we've got some brilliant questions from, Simon on, the role of quangos. Hold on. Thank you. And David Ward giving much more detail on Labour's home insulation pledge, which is significant. We've got Chris on how Frosty Frost became Frosty Frost, the nickname. George Mackey, or is it Mackay? John Mackey, sorry, or John Mackay, John Mackey. Let me know, John, how you pronounce the surname. On alternative policies that could have followed the crises of the 70s. Was Thatcherism inevitable or not? Whole podcast in that, John. Andrew Kitching, looking back at where Labour got this reputation for being economically irresponsible. And when you think about Labour governments, tried, or in opposition, tried to establish fiscal rules and all the rest of it to show how they were going to pay for things. And Andrew roots it in the International Monetary Fund crisis of 76, when they had to borrow money to keep going. So that's really interesting. James Ashton, who lives in China and offers to serve as an ambassador for our great collective, will all come over and see you in China, James. Yeah, he was somebody who voted for Corbyn, became disillusioned with Corbyn, voted for Owen Smith in that attempted coup, which didn't get anywhere. He wants some more behind-the-scenes analysis of the Corbyn era. I recommend a book, actually, James, by Patrick McGuire and one other co-author from the Sunday Times. It's a brilliant book. They wrote it and got fantastic access. Yeah, but we'll do a podcast on what really happened. And yeah, oh God, so many others. Forgive me. I'll come back to them. Do subscribe. Because there might be another one this week. You just want it to arrive without having to check. And do tell your friends to subscribe and your family to subscribe. It's compulsory. The nanny state of the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative. Anyway, look, thank you so much. It's going to be a busy week. So enjoy yourselves, have some fun. But we've got to delve deep and make sense of it again very, very soon. Thanks very much. Bye.